one of my characters recently, the description of them just said, wears socks and sandals. And I was like, yeah, that's all you need to know about him.
Conveys so much.
Rusty Quill presents Enthusiasm. Hello, friends and fans, and welcome to Enthusiasm, the show where we talk about a few of our favourite things. I am your host, Helen Gould, one of the best Rusty Quillers. Today, we're talking about costuming and cosplay, and I am beside myself to be joined by Francesca, Mabel, and Nemo. So, let's do this alphabetically as always. Francesca, can you please give us your pronouns and tell us what you do?
Most certainly. So my name is Francesca and I'm she, they. I play Julia Montauk on the Magnus Archives. And I like that you gave yourself the title of one of the best Rusty Quillers, best thing in the world. I'm into it. I'm a drag king. I'm a comedian, improviser. I do clowning in refugee camps. I facilitate, I direct, I do a whole bunch of stuff. So that's me in a nutshell.
That is a whole bunch of stuff. Wow, I didn't even know you did all that.
Yeah.
Very well done. Okay, and mate, I had to run through the alphabet just then. I was like, does M or N come first?
Just doing the song.
Yeah, just the quick bit of the song. Mabel, please give us your pronouns and tell us what you do.
Hello. Yes, I am Mabel Syrup. My pronouns are she and her. And I am a drag queen. And also, I do other things that are not associated with drag queening and not hugely relevant right now.
That's fine. It is relevant for this episode. And finally, Nemo, what's your pronouns and what do you do?
Hello, I'm Nemo. I use they, them pronouns. And for Rusty Quill, I'm the lead writer of a podcast called Trice Forgotten.
Should I have talked about the Rusty Quill things that I did? That's fine, right?
Oh, yeah, go for it. Yeah.
Should I just add that now? I have also done some voice acting for Rusty Quill. Move on with your lives.
And Nemo, do you do anything else you'd like to mention other than the amazing podcast that you're going to be writing for us?
I'm mostly a writer, to be honest. Yeah, so I write theatre and I write podcasts and I produce plays. So, yeah.
Oh, God, I'm so excited to have you on board. Like, I love the whole concept of the show. I'm just generally feeling very enthusiastic today.
Yay!
Okay. So, we're going to start with like a nice, easy establishing question, which is, what got you into the idea of costuming and clothing as performance? Like, why is that interesting? Why is that something that you decided to look into or pursue? I personally do not do anything with my clothes professionally, but it's something that I'm very interested in terms of how the way you can choose to look can inform your identity and vice versa. And the whole thing about gender and identity being a performance is something that I'm super interested in and enjoy playing with a lot.
That's really cool. Sorry, that's like almost the entire opposite of the thing that I love about costumes.
Oh, yeah?
On a personal day-to-day level, I have literally never put any thought. It's like jeans, t-shirt, done, whatever, don't give a damn. And like the thing that I have always loved about costumes since like really, really tiny is being a character, being a different person who is not me. Like just like being able to put something on and immediately just inhabiting someone else. Like that's what I love about it. It's just sort of like, what would this character, what would this person wear and why and stuff like that. Whereas like on my own personal level, I couldn't care less.
It is cool how, because I did do a bit of theatre, like when you wear the character's clothes, it completely changes your like entire mannerisms, especially if they're not clothes that you would usually wear.
Yeah. Like it suddenly you just feel open to so many more like ways of being just because you're wearing someone else's clothes. It's really cool.
Yes. Yeah, I hear that. What about you, Francesca?
I feel like in terms of a theatrical sense, like I've been performing since I was three, dancing and whatnot. And at drama school, I kind of developed my process in terms of I went to a method acting Stanislavski in drama school of East 15. And so therefore it was very internal in terms of process, but we did do a lot of Laban. And I discovered that actually for me, the externality was much more useful because I'm quite an esoteric person as it is. So, you know, if I start thinking about what bottle of perfume I am or what caliber of caviar I am in terms of personification, I can get a little bit stuck in that. Whereas if I allow my body via the use of Laban or Lecoq or other sort of movement styles, if I allow my body to kind of morph into different shapes, I find that costume is an extension of that for me.
Mm.
One can inform the other. I feel like it's a symbiotic relationship. Like one can inform the other and one can spur the other on. But I think, you know, they are very indispensable in regards to each other. But for me as a drag performer, I'm Brent Wood, W-O-U-L-D, because I would anything, literally anything, especially you. That's his tagline. That was a whole different world for me, in so much as I, as a person, have always loved fashion and dressing differently. You know, when I was younger, I'm still very much into metal and rock and punk and stuff. So I felt like the way I dressed as a kid was a very transgressive act. It was me kind of saying, you know, up yours to the system. And I think that when I discovered drag, I've always felt like I didn't, inverted commas, woman properly, whatever that means. And it doesn't mean anything. Of course, it's a binary construct. But being allowed the freedom to inhabit that space meant like I got given a lot more slack. So it's been a real like head spinner being able to enter that space. But my character has evolved recently. And there's a lot more sort of gender f***ery, if you will, with my performance art versus just being a very masculinized thing. But I think it inhabits a range of spaces and the clothing is extremely pivotal to that. Such a long answer. Kill
no,
me.
No, it's a great answer.
That's really cool.
I want to go back a little bit. Can you talk to me as a non-professionally trained person? Can you talk about what, do you say Laban and Lecoq? What were those?
They're just movement languages or schools of movement. So like Laban, he has some questionable ties now, we realise, to the Nazi regime. But outside of that, his work was really interesting because he created a language for movement. He worked a lot with people who were women, particularly that were in munitions factories and were committing movements that were not their natural flow, and seeing how that had affected them. And it's, you know, when you work as a company or if you work with actors, it's a way of talking about movement and intention. Because, you know, if a director says to you, like, be angry, like, what does that mean culturally, in terms of gender, in terms of you individually, the family you grew up in? Anger, such like a nondescript word to say realistically, because it has so many different permutations. Whereas like if you're able to approach something from a more movement effort based perspective, I personally find that that can be a lot more helpful. And I've done a lot of work teaching directors how to do that. And I think costume sort of gets on board with that. And Lecoq is kind of more clowning and movement stuff as well. So again, going into the area of bouffant and the various different sort of iterations of clown.
That's absolutely fascinating. I'm going to have to do an episode about theatre. Because I don't know any of this stuff. That's totally true. Like, if you ask me to act angry, what I'm going to do is going to be very different to what, say, Lori might do or what Alex might do.
It's also a very hollow reaction because it's like, where did it come from? Unless you know where you've built from or the impetus, it's just the performance of an emotion like a kid would do when they're mucking about. Whereas like for you to genuinely embody that and to be truthful, because acting after all is about telling the truth versus lying, I think that's the common misconception. It has to come from a real place.
Wow. Gosh, yes, I knew this was going to be a good episode. Nemo, talk to me about why you're interested in costumes and cosplay and stuff like that.
I feel like mine is very similar to yours, what you said about like gender play. And I was trying to think of like the first time this would have come up for me. And I was thinking about RuneScape or other like MMORPGs and stuff like that. And like buying costumes for your characters. And as a kid, I always bought like male clothing for my characters and always made my character look male or masculine, or would be wearing like knight's armor and stuff like that. So I feel like it's part of that. I'm not a performer myself. I'm a writer solidly behind the screens. will never ever be on stage and also dress like a child like anime t-shirts and like the stained shorts of a weeb, but I really like dressing up my characters, and I used to love playing those, you know, like those games for girls which were like you got a little doll and then you like put them in
loads of
like costumes.
Dolldivine.com.
Yeah, I loved all of those
I
things.
Love them so much.
And it's so weird because like I hate dressing up myself and I hate like I hate being looked at perceived but I do love the idea of like costuming someone to be a character and like writing a character and like I know what they're wearing. One of my characters recently, the description of them just said wears socks and sandals, and I was like, yeah, that's all you need to know about him.
Conveys so much.
Exactly.
I love this. So this means you're coming at it from the other side of the stage, I guess.
Yeah.
The other side of the wings, the other side of the backdrop. Because I often have a very strong idea of what all my characters look like as well.
Mm.
So when you've done plays and stuff, have you had input into the costumes you've put people in and what they've been wearing?
Not really. I mean, so far, so I'm only a baby playwright, so I've only had a couple of things ever been staged. And so, I'm trying, you know, there is that thing in theatre where it's kind of like the writer kind of needs to give away the child at some point, right? And like, you have to trust that your costume designers and your set designers and your designers are going to design the characters and that they're going to take it. And even the actors, you know, and I really, really appreciate when actors put their own thought into it and often come up with costumes that are far more suited to the character than I would ever think. And so, you know, there is part of me that's kind of sad that I don't get to like dress up my little dolls and like, you know, move them around the stage. But I have written a couple of plays where the actors have put so much like thought and input into how their character dresses that I've been like, okay, yeah, you get to play in my little headspace now too, I guess.
Okay, well, since we're on sort of this topic of theatre, do any of you remember any particular costumes or things where you're like, they've done a really good job with that? It doesn't have to be theatre, but like, because it's just the fashion and style and design of characters is something that I always pay a lot of attention to.
I have one if other people need thinking time.
Go.
Okay.
Yeah, go.
The version of Twelfth Night that the National Theatre did that had Tamsin Gregg in. Does anyone remember that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like that one I was so in awe of because it refused to be pinned down to an era or a style or anything like that, but it was still so cohesive. And I was just like, because I could never have created something like that myself. Like, I'm not a student of fashion or anything like that. And so like my approaches to designing things are very like, this is the theme down the line. We'll work with whatever theme I've come up with or whatever. But like the way that they did that was so like just beyond anything I could have created myself and so impressive that because it was like interesting to watch. And yeah, like with all of the staging on it of it and everything, it just refused to be one thing. It refused to be like, and this is set in this era. No, it's not. Like, we've got sunglasses but also like massive fancy dresses, or and then sometimes someone's wearing leggings, who knows, like it, but it all worked together so brilliantly. I was so impressed by the design of that show.
It's kind of funny. I was genuinely also actually thinking of that production, but
For me, I've got a very dear friend called Amy Jackson, and she's an incredibly talented costume designer. And she used to design all of the Chish Festival Youth Theatre productions, but also like loads of other stuff as well. But I was so utterly blessed to like go to that youth theatre because it's one of the best in the country, and our costumes were so high end. I really took myself seriously as a performer. And she designed, you know, The Wizard of Oz with really high-end conceptual stuff, very sort of visually appealing. It wasn't just like some amateur dramatic kids show. Like, the costumes were stunning. And when I got to play Nancy and Oliver, the designs that she would draw by hand and then she would also draw on a digital tablet in themselves are pieces of art. And so getting to wear the finalised version of it and to see them realised physically was just so gorgeous. And like getting to see that process from start to finish and to see her progress and make even more beautiful things for like a whole range of shows or one-off events now is really exciting. Like, it's not, I don't have that skill set, and so to watch someone be able to do that is really a beautiful thing to be able to witness. And I'm also really into like structural stuff that's almost like sculptural, that it kind of goes beyond clothing and it becomes almost sort of a piece of building or an architecture that is around the body. And also, I don't know why now, I'm thinking about the Skeksis from The Dark Crystal. I just, that sort of stuff that kind of goes in between costuming and puppetry feel like it kind of like is in a bit of a liminal space between the two.
I was about to say that one of the costumes that's been in my head for, like, since I was a kid is that dress that Jennifer thingy wears in Labyrinth.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's like the, where it's the ball scene. Oh. And she has all these like tassels and ribbons and glittery things in her hair and this massive silver and white sparkling dress, and it just looks like such a it looks like a dream. Like, the dress literally looks like a dream, and it is a dream. She's in a hallucination. And then David Bowie turns up and he's got blue highlights in his hair and this like dark blue suit and his eyeliner and eyeshadow out to here, and I'm just looking at both of them like, yes, yes, all of this.
I agree.
Yeah, like, he got the assignment. He knew exactly what he was doing.
Like, the styling in Labyrinth is really interesting because the costume changes are interesting. I remember reading somewhere that the shirt that Sarah starts off with at the beginning gradually gets more and more fantastical and more sort of tunic-like than actually shirt-like as she gets closer in. And I also really remember the sort of owl outfit that Jareth wears right at the end, where it's just like, it's all cream-coloured and covered in feathers.
Yeah.
And, oh, it's great. It's great. And the whole set, they just went to the set with glitter. They got like a glitter, like a leaf blower, but for glitter, and just put it all over the place.
I worked an event some years ago, you talking about that fantastical element, where we were advertising tablets from a tech brand, but they'd had Marc Jacobs create a dress that housed these tablets, and then they all showed an image on them that moved, and that was the fabric of the dress.
Wow.
That stands out to me again as like an exciting interpretation of an outfit.
In on the kind of fashion theme, and like, I don't know many fashion designers, but it's about to sound like I do. for in terms of like loving structural things, do you know Iris van Herpen?
I know the name.
Oh my goodness. Look up Iris van Herpen stuff because you would love it. Okay. Like, all of her stuff is basically, it's about structure and like parts of it move and stuff like that. But it's gorgeous and it's like really, really intricate. I think a lot of it is like either like laser printed and things like that, like 3D printed and stuff. And it's like so incredibly delicate. Like, there are things that look like the really delicate bones of like a bird and stuff like that. But it's all very structured and three-dimensional and things. And she's done photo shoots where someone's wearing the dress doing skydiving and stuff like that. It's just like, her stuff is just beautiful and completely wild. Like, oh, I love it for exactly that reason. Like, it's walking art.
Yeah, like, some of these, they look like people are wearing like pieces of coral or
the just sea. Like that. And she also specializes in things looking like almost like they're growing out of the skin of the people wearing them. Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Lovely.
Did you ever watch an anime called Jellyfish Princess?
No, but that sounds great.
It's a really cute anime. I really recommend it. So it's about this like really like nerdy person who wants to design dresses, and she bases them off of these jellyfish. She like goes to the aquarium a lot, and she sees these jellyfish, and these designs Iris herpen, herpen dresses
herpen.
Look a lot like the ones that were like inspired by jellyfish because of that like really fluid kind of line like very like ethereal natural thing where you're like it's so ethereal it doesn't look natural but it is so natural.
Another Iris who I think is an absolute style icon is Iris Apfel. Do you know her?
No.
The name rings a bell, but I can't.
So there was this documentary called Advanced Style, and that was about women over the age of 60, I think, but like being extremely stylish. It's so heartening and glorious and wonderful. And she's one of the main ones in that, and she's just absolutely...
Is she famous for having like those big round black glasses?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is the person I was thinking of, yeah.
She's such a legend. When I think of, like, people that I loved and I think about the way they dress and I love it, I think, like, Angela Bassett is absolutely stunning and is just really, like, has this classic, very tailored look. Iris Apfel's got this, like, mad, kind of artistic, vibrant look. And then I always think of Frida Kahlo and her beautiful traditional dress and just the colours and the weave and the weft and the shape and the... import and the importance of her clothing. Those kind of float around in my head.
Sorry, you said her name Iris Apfel?
Yeah.
Oh, she was in that, she was in an advert in the cinema.
Turn off your phone, lads. I've got my glasses on.
Yes, I remember her. I thought she looked amazing then as well. Good for her.
Good for her.
Do you know what? I think on that, I'm going to take a break. And when we come back, I really want to talk more about drag since we have organically gotten to this conclusion. But listener, we'll see you in a minute. And welcome back. So we've gone onto the topic of drag, which I love. I haven't seen a lot of drag, though I would like to. Talk to me about it. Tell me how you got involved, or if you've seen it, or if you like it, or if you haven't. Someone start off, because I can tell this is a little bit of a hot button topic.
Well, I mean, I started drag by starting to do burlesque classes and being like, I like this. This is fun. Oh, this is basically drag. Drag and burlesque are the same thing. I get to go to drag shows and I basically really, really enjoy watching drag. And so when I perform, it's just like, cool, I get to see a show for free. That's awesome. And also it's a way of doing theatre without having to rely on other people, which, it's hard. So that is an appealing aspect of it.
What about you, Francesca?
I got into drag because I was having a very difficult time with a fizzy brain, 2014 particularly. And I started watching RuPaul's Drag Race, which I understand is obviously pretty problematic in many ways, but obviously that is evolving. But, you know, there's definitely a lot of ground to cover. And I'm part of a drag scene whereby we are pushing forward for better representation and inclusivity and for the same opportunities for, you know, our trans siblings and performers from a variety of different ethnic backgrounds who are not being given as much platforming. Mm-hmm. So all of that being said, that was where I sort of entered into it visually. My mum used to go on about drag queens all the time. She used to talk about her friends Bob and Barry, her two gay mates. I mean, she wasn't particularly the most politically correct person, but she was trying. And so obviously when I was a little queer button, she sort of took me to drag shows and it would happen a little bit. And I got into RuPaul's Drag Race and it gave me something to think of and to get my mind off of stuff, really. It was just this fantastical escape of people who equally had probably had a bit of a tough road to hoe. And I'd been a performer all my life. And again, I would totally agree with you that it is theatre without having to rely on everybody else. But when you do get to rely on people and it's symbiotic and beautiful, it's an absolute stunner because you get community and really beautiful things. And it was an exploration of different facets of myself as a performer. And it just felt punk and anarchic. And, you know, in the East London drag scene is so different to the North London drag scene, to the South London drag scene. Oh. And then the rest of the country, it's like this incredible patchwork within this country and in other countries internationally of so many extremely creative and brave, beautiful people. And I thought, yeah, I reckon that looks good. I'll try that on.
Excellent. Nima, do you have any experience watching drag or being involved in it?
I don't. Drag is one thing that I haven't really been involved in. But I did want to say, like, recently, I guess, in British theatre, there has been... So I saw a performance of Twelfth Night at the Globe Theatre, which had a drag queen in it. She's called Le Gâteau Chocolat. And she's so incredible. I love her so much. She's also an opera singer. And it was just such a, like, it was such a beautiful... So the Globe Theatre, she just kind of emerges singing opera. She's, like, quite a big black lady with a full thick beard in, like, a...
Oh, I love it.
...beautiful ball gown. And, like, in a show like Twelfth Night, where it's so much about gender play and, like, costume and... Yeah, it was just such a... I was watching it and I was like, oh yeah, like, you know, things like this can happen and it be used as not just a, what am I trying to say? Like, I feel like I have seen quite a few drag shows and I really enjoy them. And I love what they are in performance and that they can be so many versatile things. And watching this drag performer in a play was like, oh yeah, drag can be this as well. It can be, we can see drag in so many different places. And yeah, I just think it's a really cool art form. And obviously in things like Shakespeare, where you're already playing with like actor gender and character gender, things like drag. And yeah, I just found it so, like, it's so memorable. And I still think about it to this day.
I love Le Gâteau Chocolat as well. Their show Icons that I saw at Soho Theatre was absolutely sublime and their voice is divine. So hard agree with you there. I also think it's really interesting, though, that within the world of drag that there is like a lot of misogyny, trans misogyny and other issues in terms of like not having the same spaces for like non-cis white male performers and sometimes this adherence to the gender binary. You're out there saying like, oh yeah, whatever, damn the patriarchy and down with the binary, but then, you know, AFAB performers or people who've been socialized as female are not given the same platform, and you're told that it's kings or queens or it's just queens that you want. But actually, there are drag monarchs, drag monsters, drag things, drag princes with X's and without X's. Like, there is a whole universe of possibility, and all drag is valid. And for anybody to like step out there and be like, no, this is not how it's done, they're just reinforcing the societal norms. And like, I totally agree with you, to see it in a theatre show, you know, you've got Death Drop the Play at the moment, which is an all drag performer cast. I think there's so many possibilities and I think it should be normalised and people should see themselves represented 110%.
No, I totally agree. Like, the drag that that really got me into it and that I really opened my eyes is like the indie stuff, like the stuff that you will go to a theater that is near you and or like a pub or whatever that is near you. And it's like when you're at school and you learn all of the rules of writing, right? And it's just like, and these are the rules of sentence structure and these are the rules of like, you know, like how you form everything. And then you go, and then there's poetry and you throw all of those rules away. And like, it was that thing of going like, you know how you've learned that there are kinds of art that are valid? Like, this is art and this is not art. When you go to like a drag show or like an indie cabaret show, what it does is literally just go like, no, no, this is a stage. And if someone decides to do something on the stage, that is their art. And this is a place where we celebrate that. Like, it's so phenomenally freeing to just be like, oh no, you don't have to do anything. You don't have to fit in a box. You don't have to tick anything. Like, you can do whatever speaks to you. And there are places where people will go, yes, just yes. And that lends itself so brilliantly to supporting people who are not, who can't find places in mainstream art. And it's so ridiculous to me. Like, this is something that I've been like writing about recently, is like things like burlesque are really like, I don't know, like side-eyed by mainstream society as superficial, right? Strip art in general is really side-eyed as it's like, well, it's just about the body and it's just like, it's really sexist and all this kind of stuff. Whereas like other dance forms like ballet are considered to be like, this is high art. This transcends those kind of superficial interests of just sort of like, oh, you know, it's just about what your body looks like. I have never been in a room more concerned with the size of my body than a ballet class. And I have never been in a room less concerned with what my body looks like than a burlesque dance class. Like, it is the entire opposite. But it is like in mainstream art and because a lot of it is about monetary success, it celebrates and reifies a really certain specific kind of art. And then it excludes other people who can't access or can't produce that art, often like because of monetary constraints or all sorts of other things like lack of representation, all that kind of stuff. They don't see themselves in it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas because drag is kind of underground and punk, and it's still often, with some exceptions, in that like indie space, it is that place to just be like, no, you can do anything. Anything is art. Your body is art. Like, I don't care that you've not seen it in other places. Your body is art and it can do art. And I just love that about it. And like, I will fight to keep drag that and not let it become that thing of like, no, you've got to tick these boxes. It's not drag unless you do X, Y, Z. Mm. Like, that's rubbish.
110%. And I'd say, like, you know, Ruby Jones, Three Wise, Prince Chio, yes. Romeo de la Cruz. I think, you know, those individuals typify that as well. And the Christine Machine is... Have you ever seen the Christine Machine?
No.
No, not at all.
They're an American performer, but they're like absolutely... gorgeously vile and stunning and horrific and all at the same time. And they make my heart so happy because they're just so otherworldly. And I think they kind of almost fall into the world of Buffon in terms of clowning, but I would really highly recommend checking them out.
Nemo, earlier you were going to say something about drag and I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, I was actually thinking, so with what Mabel was just saying about like kind of pushing the needle with performers and stuff. This is actually not about drag, but it is still about costumes, so bear with me.
Yeah, absolutely, let's go for it.
But actually, Francesca also mentioned it at the beginning, like about punk and about transgressive like clothing. And and I was thinking about this episode and I was thinking about cosplay and I was thinking about the Japanese trend of ganguro, which... because of Japanese beauty standards of like pale skin, straight dark hair, being very thin, being very petite, that I'm half Japanese is why I feel like I should say that because I'm talking about a culture, that this is something that I'm aware of, that so teenage girls would start like dyeing their hair like bleach blonde and darkening their skin. And there is like some political stuff about it. Like there can be a whole conversation about black facing and there can be a whole conversation about, the politics of darkening your skin. And for these people, it was a way of showing that they would not tolerate being in this system anymore. That was like focused on like skin, like bleach, that whiteness of your skin to the point of bleaching it. My aunt is someone who doesn't go outside without wearing like full length black clothing in order to make sure that her skin stays like milky white because of the like and so what these girls would do was like make themselves look as quote unquote unappealing as possible. And I really liked that. And that became like a fashion style. It became something that people went to go and see because it was like, wow, you're like doing activism by like body modding and that kind of stuff. And it made me think when you were talking about drag and about these performers who are, because it's about like heightening things, right? I mean, from my like outsider's perspective, it seems to me as if it's about heightening things, but also like making things, I guess romanticizing things that are monstrous or have been termed monstrous or like reclaiming things and pushing things. And I just really like it made me think of these girls who did that. And there have been like other trends in Japan since then. It's like thinking about what is ugly, thinking about like beauty standards, thinking about very culturally specific beauty standards and how they get created into costumes. And that's a whole other conversation about like cultural appropriation and stuff, which I know that we don't have time for. But yeah, I really like enjoyed listening to this conversation because it is so interesting to see how, even if you're not part of an industry, everyone is sort of like thinking about the same things and talking about them in different ways and using costume to talk about them in different ways. And even if you wouldn't call Gangur or drag, it still has the same like base underneath it.
Yeah.
That's super interesting. Thank you for sharing.
For me, it comes down to the fact that I think clothing is political.
Yes. Yes.
Just fundamentally.
I love that.
And the freedom to think that your clothing is not political is also in itself part of politics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, like one of my favorite quotes, and what I can't even assign it to anyone, and also it's been bastardized a billion times, but like, for a fat woman to love herself is a political act, and fundamentally for anyone to love their appearance is a political act, because capitalism is built around telling us we're inadequate so it can sell us more things to make us more palatable. And so just loving the way that you look is political in and of itself. It is a rejection of everything trying to tell you that you are inadequate. But then there's like all sorts of other things on top of it. Like, as a fat person, it is so difficult to find, and especially I am very unusually proportioned, and it is pretty much impossible to find tops that fit me. They don't really exist. And I have only recently started like making some of my own clothes, and the like awe I felt the first time I wore something that was made to fit me was wild. Like, I cannot convey to people who are straight-sized the sheer joy of putting something on your body and realizing that your body is not wrong when the clothes are made to fit it. Like, oh, I can have joy in clothing because it fits me now. Like, that is such a joyous thing to feel. And like, it is denied to so many people because of like the way that fast fashion works and the way that clothes are made on a very specific kind of mannequin and form. But like, yeah, so much of clothing is political. And, oh my God, going back to the Met Gala thing, the Notes on Camp theme was like such a great demonstration of that, and how, I don't know, I like how some people really, really understood that and how some people didn't quite understand that.
Yeah.
But like, I think the best explanation of camp that I had, because lots of people were trying to define it in like in the run-up and in the aftermath of that particular one, was someone who basically said like, camp is a rejection of the male gaze, of the like heterosexual male gaze. It's going like, I will dress in a way that does not cater to you at all. And I really, really like that as a description of it. And
it's really interesting.
Yeah, it opened it up to mean so much more than just like over the top and I'm wearing pink and like it's really big and all that kind of stuff that you generally associate with drag queens and stuff like that. It's just like, no, it doesn't have to be that. It's just a rejection of, this has to be palatable for heterosexual men. Like,
it's so tough though, because I feel like, even though my logical brain says all of these things to me, I definitely do have those moments where I'm like, oh, do I look good? And then I'm like, oh, stop it. Like, you don't owe anyone pretty, but it's this constant fight, particularly, I think, if you're a millennial or an elder millennial, if you look at the coverage of clothing and bodies during that time, it was some of the most toxic
it was bonkers.
There has ever been. And so I think that there's a lot to unpack there. And also in regards to when you're talking about clothing being political, the real strength of the politics of it as well is these hidden figures who are not being paid enough, who are making these things for us to look pretty, but they're not even able to survive. Like these women, children, men who are like working away in factories. Like, yeah, there's like a political ramification to literally everything in the world. And for people to be like, I'm not political, it makes me want to vom in my own mouth.
I want to try and talk about, it can be any kind of clothing. For my examples, I'm going to pick a costume, but like something that's made you feel like powerful or good about yourself. I want us to round off on talking about that, because I think looking back on it now, like regular listeners of the show will know that that I recently this year realized that I'm gender fluid, right? Mm. And then I did that thing where you look back through your life and you're like, oh, right, yeah, I see. And one of those moments was when I went to a convention and I was dressed as the Winter Soldier. Mm. And I swear I have never felt more powerful than when most of my face was covered up.
Yeah.
And there was like, you could barely tell anything about any of my gender markers or anything. But the idea that I could like, that I could see and recognize people and they could not see me, it was really bizarre and still, and so intense, the power that I felt wearing that costume. And I had that again when I started experimenting with like different types of clothing, like seriously. And I was like, oh, I can look like this. Mm. Oh, I see. This is very interesting. But yeah, that cosplay as the Winter Soldier has really stuck with me. Mm. And I also think a lot about how a lot of the, I don't make it a habit, but a lot of the cosplays I've done have involved masks in some way. Like I dressed up as the Witch King one time, and I got like a special pointy helmet with sort of a balaclava thing underneath. I dressed up as Gaster, who is from Undertale, and I had like a white mask on with like spooky face drawn on it. So I think a lot of costuming as well can be to do with what it is to see and be seen as well. And so for me, it was like the power dynamic got completely shifted for me. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Mm.
That's very cool.
Yeah, it was like, you might look, but you can't see.
It's a weird thing that, like, I sort of know a weird fact that connects what you've just said with the thing about Japan and fashion.
Which
is like there was a trend for like facekinis, precisely for what you were talking about like people not wanting to expose their skin to the sun. And so like basically swimwear that like entirely covered your face as well. It almost looked like club kid kind of masks. And then people realizing they felt so confident and so like just entirely different sides of them coming out because it was the anonymity of having that, of just being like, I cannot be identified. You can't, like, you don't know me kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I just thought that was a really weird link.
No, it makes sense. But, and also I think, because we can't just like leave it there. I think it's a very different experience to choosing to wear a mask than having to wear a mask because there is a virus outside that can kill you. But we will move swiftly on. Nemo, is there any kind of clothing or costume that has made you feel particularly happy or powerful or good?
Yeah, again, we're very similar in that. So the one I immediately thought of was I cosplayed Baze Malbus from Star Wars. And it was watching Rogue One was the first time really that I'd seen like a Western film with a like chunky Asian dude with like long hair who wasn't like a martial arts pro, and he was just like really tired and he was really cool and funny and like just like really human. And so I cosplayed him, and it was like he has these like this like really long hair, and at the time I had very short hair, but right now I have very long hair because like after cosplaying him, and I cosplayed him like just as I was starting testosterone, and it was such a like, oh wow, I can feel so masculine and cool and like funny and like this character and confident while having really long hair and while not looking like manly man. And I think there is that thing of like, yeah, gender and race, the like intersections of it, where if you are only watching Western media, you don't get to see played with, especially with East Asian men who are often like made effeminate, and mm-hmm. East Asian women who are like highly sexualized and highly fetishized. And so this this Baze Malbus saved my life kind of thing, where like every time I look at photos of that cosplay and I'm like, ah, I just, it's so cool. And now I've because lockdown happened, I was like, oh, I'll just grow my hair out and see what happens. And now I really love having really long hair. And I didn't think that I would ever come to the place where I would have that. So yeah, that's...
Oh, I'm so happy for you. Also, like, Rogue One is very underrated.
So underrated.
I really liked it. Such a good film.
Mabel, how about you? You mentioned the top that you were able to make for yourself. Yeah. Is there anything else that you would like to... Yeah,
so in that theme, just generally, there was you can't pinpoint it, but there was a point at which I went, I really like crop tops. really, really like crop tops.
Love a crop top.
And like now 90% of what I wear when I'm not at work or whatever is crop tops, because I love them and I love the way I look in them. And I can so vividly remember the point in my life not that long ago where it would be like, oh, nobody wants to see that. Mm-hmm. And it just, like, for some reason, that is not me anymore. And that's glorious. Mm-hmm. That's a glorious feeling. I love crop tops.
I'm very happy.
I will wear them till the day I die. but in terms of costuming and stuff, oh, there's so many things that I absolutely love. Like, there's a couple bits from some of my acts that, I have an act where I'm Thanos.
And, love it.
I strip as sexy Thanos.
Whoa.
I had made some middle finger nipple pasties, and I made them in like sparkly gold.
Oh my god.
My housemate, who is a genius, so I'd made them in like sparkly gold, and he was just like, just put the infinity stones on them. So now I have middle finger nipple pasties with the infinity stones on.
Oh my god.
Like infinity gauntlet nipple pasties. And they are glorious things, along with like these like gold cage panties that I made. And like there are some photos of me in that, and like the remnants of that act where it just means so much to me, because it was like the point at which I was happy to do strip stuff, and like it's me, like I'm almost universally putting up middle fingers in all of the photos, and also there's confetti everywhere because that's part of the act as well. And it's just like, it's so powerful and important to me, like that feeling that I now have access to, of just sort of like A, I made these things and I'm proud of that, like with, you know, some artistic help from my housemate. But also like what it means about who I am and where I am in my relationship to myself is like a big deal for me. And also the fact that I don't consider that act to be particularly femme, despite the fact that like I do consider myself to be a drag queen. Like because I'm Thanos in it, I don't consider it to be particularly gendered. It's just my body making a point about like judgment of fat bodies. I'm sounding really one note at the moment. Fatness.
I am on board.
But like it's just, but I don't consider it to be a particularly gendered act at all. And so like aesthetically, I just really, really enjoy it. Yeah. So that's sort of a big one for me.
Oh, I'm glad. Francesca, how about you?
I think like when I first started really inhabiting my drag character, that definitely has changed my relationship to my own gender. Because again, I've also sort of realised that I'm probably genderqueer.
Mm.
And that feels like a more comfortable space for me to be in. And I think that for me, there were like two kind of extremes whereby I felt extremely powerful when I wore a really nice suit for the first time.
Mm.
I think that the context is extremely important for me, even more so than the clothes sometimes, because I can wear anything in any context and not feel particularly powerful or disempowered. Context is quite key. But I think me being a teenager wearing Criminal Damage jeans and like just massive hoodies and stuff, I just felt pretty rocking, to be honest. And I don't think I've really moved past that space in many ways.
I'd forgotten the name of that brand, Criminal Damage.
We used to get Rising Damp. I couldn't afford the bus fare back to the village because I moved out of London for a bit. And so that was it. Just sat soggy and wet in a coffee shop with one coffee between 20 people.
Oh, my God.
God, I remember you used to get the catalogues. That's massive jeans. Yes. Anyway, yeah, I'm sorry, thrown back into my own days. A little punk teenager in the north of England. Soggy up to the knees. Because it's always raining.
Soggy.
Okay, we've definitely come to time now. This has been such an enlightening talk. We've managed to talk about so much stuff. I'm so pleased. Thank you so, so much for coming on.
Thank you for having us.
I'm glad you're pleased and I wasn't being naughty. I have got ADHD, so like my brain does the thing.
Oh, don't worry about
that. Okay, so do I.
Yay!
Full house.
Everybody is welcome, particularly the neurodivergent. Because there's a lot of that. And you are all very worthy and valid and we love you.
Thank you.
And on that, listeners, I hope you've had a good time as well and learned some things. I certainly have. I will see you on the next episode. But for now, it's goodbye from me. Goodbye. And it's goodbye from them. Do you want to say goodbye, everyone?
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Wear more crop tops.
Enthusiasm is a podcast distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License. It is created and hosted by Helen Gould, produced by April Sumner, and edited by Marissa Ewing. Thanks for listening.